and welcome to NextPod, VP NextGen's podcast made for veterinary students and young professionals who want to know what's next. I'm your host, Sarah Sedd, and this month's topic is vaccines and immunization. To speak on the subject is one of our NextPod members, Dr. Brennan McKenzie. Welcome, Dr. McKenzie.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So we'd love to have you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became the person that you are today.
Okay. Well, I work as a small animal clinical veterinarian in private practice in California, the Bay Area near San Francisco. And I had a bit of a winding path to get here, not the conventional story, really. I know most of the veterinarians that I work with and have met over the years have known very early in their life this is what they wanted to do and have targeted this for a long time, all the way through at least undergrad, if not earlier. My path was a little different. I'm interested in a lot of different things. I was a literature major as well as a biology major in college, and I taught English for a while. I had grown up watching a lot of the great nature shows of the 70s and 80s and decided I wanted to be Jane Goodall and live in the jungle and work with chimps. So I actually did a master's degree in primatology before I went to vet school. And I found that primatology, though a passion of mine, was a difficult thing to make a living at. And after several years of working through that, I ended up going to vet school at the University of Pennsylvania. And that was a really nice combination of my interest in and love for animals, along with doing something scientific, because I've always been interested in science and how science helps us to understand the world. And also doing something that I think has some value, right? I think what we bring to the world is useful. We help reduce suffering, and we help people with their companions and family members. And so there's some social value to that. So it was a nice combination of things. Plus, it offers the opportunity to make a living, which is not something that we shouldn't consider when we're planning a career. So that was quite some time ago. I've been in practice almost 20 years now. But what I will say to anyone who's thinking about or entering veterinary medicine is that you never stop learning and you never stop growing as a person. So along the way, I have discovered interests in areas outside of just the clinical focus of medicine. One of those is evidence-based medicine, which is a system we can talk about at some point, for using science as a foundation for making good decisions in the clinic to help us take better care of our patients. And I got involved with the Evidence-Based Veterinary Medicine Association, which is an organization of people with a similar interest or nerdy obsession with evidence-based medicine. And I actually, a couple of years ago, did a master's degree in epidemiology, which is the study of how we use science to understand health and disease. So I'm still growing and still learning, and I think there's a lot of opportunity within our profession to do that. It's one of the things that makes it so exciting.
That's awesome. Yeah, and just for everyone out there too, Dr. McKenzie does write for Veterinary Practice News, and he writes evidence-based medicine. He writes on that subject, which is awesome. And so when it comes to controversial topics, kind of vaccines and immunization, sometimes they're on the top of the list. And this is in regards to both human and animal medicine. So I was just wondering if you could share with us like what you think is the most important thing for people to know when it comes to vaccines and immunization within the veterinary industry right now.
Well, any discussion of vaccines can get very interesting and very complicated. There's a lot of science behind vaccination, and there are a lot of nuances in how we choose and develop and use vaccines, what their risks and benefits are. But any conversation about that has to start with the context. The context is that vaccination is one of the most effective medical tools available to us. And in the time since we began to understand how immunization and vaccination works, we have prevented an incredible amount of suffering and death for humans and animals using this tool. The World Health Organization has actually listed vaccination as the number one public health achievement of the 20th century. So it is an incredibly powerful tool. We have been able to actually eliminate entire diseases for humans. Smallpox is a disease that plagued us for thousands of years. Doesn't exist anymore. Polio is a disease that is very close to being eliminated right now. And in animal health, the same is true. Rinderpest is a disease that you can read about in documents from the ancient Egyptian times that has been killing cattle and damaging people's livelihoods for thousands of years. In 2001, we eliminated it through the use of vaccinations. So all of the interesting nuances and complications and controversies about vaccines have to be taken within that larger context, which is that it is an incredibly effective and powerful tool for promoting health and reducing suffering.
And how would you currently describe like the state of immunization within the vet industry today? Is it like, is it still progressing in like a, you know, what is it like?
Yeah, it's actually, we're very fortunate. It, oftentimes in veterinary medicine, we don't have the resources to generate the kind of science we want, and we often lack tools, and we look somewhat enviously at our physician counterparts at all the great toys they have. But vaccination is, in addition to being very effective, often very affordable. And that makes us lucky because we have a wide array of vaccines in all different areas of veterinary health available to us. And we're constantly developing new vaccines for diseases that we haven't previously been able to prevent, and improving the vaccines we have to make them safer and more effective. So I actually think the state of vaccination in veterinary medicine is really positive and really strong. Even within a relatively short period of time, we've been able to make tremendous advances. There are people in practice today who remember before canine parvovirus existed and when it emerged in the late 1970s and was a terrible scourge, killing, you know, thousands of dogs in all kinds of areas of the world. And a vaccine was developed within a few years, put into place. And many of us, you know, in my generation and younger veterinarians, will rarely see that disease if they're in an area where people have available the resources to use the vaccine for it and understand the need for it. So I think we're actually in a very strong place in that we have a lot of vaccine tools available to us and they work really well. As you pointed out, there is some controversy around vaccination and probably more in the human medical field than in veterinary medicine, but it bleeds over. And that does sometimes hamper our ability to use the tools in an effective way. We've seen in children, for example, the resurgence of a number of vaccine-preventable diseases, measles and whooping cough. We have, as I mentioned, almost but not completely eliminated polio, and the barrier is really more about acceptance and attitude than about the technology or the resources. So there are controversies, and as veterinarians, people coming into the profession will face that and will have to deal with some objections and misconceptions and concerns about vaccines. But overall, we have the tools, we have the information to use these vaccines in really effective ways and help our patients. And so I think it's actually a very good place to be in.
Awesome. Well, like you mentioned, the controversy, which is like, you know, the anti-vaxxers and stuff, and how it relates from human to kind of animal medicine, it bleeds through. So what, you know, based on what your experiences and everything, your research, like what is driving people to turn against vaccination? Like, why does that, where is that coming from?
Well, so to some extent, it's not new. When vaccines were first introduced 150, 200 years ago, there were objections to it. There were philosophical objections and concerns about safety and risk. There were political objections. Should the government be able to force people to have a medical procedure like a vaccination, you know, just from a philosophical point of view? And what happened is that in the early 20th century, vaccines were introduced and became widespread. And people had an intimate daily familiarity with really serious diseases, with polio and measles and mumps and things that harmed and killed children in great numbers. And those vaccines dramatically reduced that suffering. And people were able to witness that. If you had asked my grandmother how she felt about vaccines, she would have said, they're the most amazing thing ever invented. You know, she couldn't send my mother out to play with her friends in the summertime because she was afraid she'd get polio. And then along comes the polio vaccine and she's free to enjoy her life in a way she couldn't before. Mm-hmm. What has happened in some ways is that vaccines have become the victim of their own success. Most of us have grown up in a world where the diseases that we routinely prevent with vaccines in humans are very uncommon, at least in the affluent developed world. And we don't have personal experience with the harm that these diseases can cause. And that leads people, I think, to not only take for granted the technology, but to wonder if it's truly necessary and to focus on the rare risks of vaccination and forget about the benefits. So I think part of the resurgence of anti-vaccine concerns in the developed world has to do with just people's lack of a personal experience with the benefits that they bring. Mm-hmm. Now, you can trace some of the resistance and hesitancy to some more specific events. There was an infamous paper published in the medical journal, The Lancet, that purported to show a connection between vaccination and autism in children. The paper was eventually retracted. There was actual fraud as well as just bad science in the research. The doctor who published it had his medical license stripped. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of studies have since been done showing that this connection doesn't exist, that it's not real. But it's very easy to put fear in people's minds, and it's very hard to use facts to take that fear away again. So I think that that idea is the genesis of a lot of the hesitancy that people have about vaccinating their children, even though it's been pretty clearly disproven. And it's very common for pet owners to take concerns and ideas they have about health from human medicine and apply them to their pets. And so I think that some of the hesitancy that pet owners have about using vaccines in companion animals comes from the same anxieties that they have either personally or have heard about in the media regarding vaccination of children. And some of that is concerns about safety. Some of that, as I said, is concerns about whether these vaccines are truly necessary or not. And I think it's important for us as veterinarians or aspiring veterinarians to be educated and informed about these kinds of concerns. And being educated means understanding the science, understanding the reality of what risks vaccines have and what risks they don't have, but people may be afraid of, and also understanding where the concerns come from. You cannot educate your clients and help the public to understand their options and their choices effectively if you don't first understand and acknowledge where their concerns come from. And so I have conversations about vaccination with clients every day. This is a routine part of my work. And if I march into an exam room with a very arrogant and strident attitude about their concerns and then dismissive towards them, I'm not going to effectively do my job in terms of showing people what they really could do to prevent disease and to help their pet's health. So I think it's important that we understand the roots of these concerns and the history behind this, and also the science, and then we find a way to connect with our clients so that we can see that we're on the same side, right? We're both interested in the well-being of the pet, and we have information that they may not have, and we have a way of understanding the risks and the benefits that they may not have access to, and we can help them to make choices rather than dictating to them. I think that's a big part of overcoming vaccine hesitancy, is just how we understand the concerns and respond to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because my one of my questions was actually how can young professionals and students almost prepare to address these concerns when they are practicing eventually when it comes to vaccines? And now my question would be in that regard, now that people have access to the internet and videos and YouTube and and obviously it will continue to grow as these students are becoming, you know, going into the profession, how can they address the client's concerns when they're, maybe the client has been fed all this misinformation or has been, you know, watching these things that are amplifying their own beliefs? Like, is there a way to go about that?
Sure. I mean, it is a challenge, and it's a challenge for several reasons. We are in a time in history where I think faith and confidence in science and an understanding of the benefits that science has brought us in terms of our everyday lives is retreating a little bit. The period of time after the Second World War and after the advent of antibiotics and vaccination saw a great understanding among the general public of the benefits that a scientific understanding of the world and of health could bring. And I think some of us, you know, born since then are a little spoiled, and we lack that perspective. So you will have to overcome that. People will not necessarily understand that you're a more reliable source of information as a veterinarian than the guy on YouTube or the kid working at Petco or whatever other source of information they have. So hopefully as time moves forward, as we all get a little more competent in using this amazing information technology that we have available to us, we'll get better at distinguishing reliable and unreliable sources, at information that is ideological, information that is science-based. So at the moment, there are some challenges in dealing with that. And ultimately, you know, there will be people who have rigid and strong beliefs that you are not going to be able to overcome or challenge. And you have to have a certain degree of acceptance about that. But I think the vast majority of pet owners and clients that I encounter have concerns and questions rather than a rigid anti-vaccine belief system. And they are open to understanding what the real risks and benefits are and why vaccination is, in almost all cases, going to be better for their pets than not doing vaccines. And part of overcoming their anxiety and their hesitancy is being informed. Now, there's some great resources out there. There are vaccine guidelines for veterinarians that are put together by groups of specialists, and they are a nice, short, quick way of saying, here's what's recommended, and here's a list of resources for looking into, you know, what are the side effects of vaccines, what are the limitations, how do we know they're effective. The American Animal Hospital Association has a guideline that is widely used as the standard for vaccination in dogs for deciding what's appropriate, when, and how. The American Academy of Feline Practitioners has a similar guideline for cats, and all of these are freely available online. So those are very quick and efficient resources. The World Small Animal Veterinary Association has a set of guidelines, which is a great resource internationally, since we can't just speak to people in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's also actually a really great book that just came out this year called Vaccines for Veterinarians. It's written by an immunologist at Texas A&M University. And it is a fantastic series of small, short, digestible chapters that look at the history of vaccines, how vaccines work, and specific vaccination practices for different species. And that's a fantastic resource. And I think any veterinarian who is going to be having these conversations on a daily basis with the general public should have that and should read it and should be familiar with what kinds of questions they're likely to get and what the real or science-based answer is to them. There are also ways to reach out besides your everyday clinical practice. As you mentioned, I write a column for Veterinary Practice News, and I write about vaccination and concerns about vaccines frequently. That's primarily targeted at veterinarians and veterinary technicians, so that tends to have the technical information and the references for people who want to look at the science. But I also have a blog, the SkepVet blog, and I'm very active through that on Facebook and Twitter. I've even done a few YouTube videos, you know, which shows that, you know, old guys can do YouTube sometimes too. And I try to use those more as a platform for reaching out to the general public, because I think that it's important for scientists in general, and especially for healthcare professionals like veterinarians, to know that we don't operate in a vacuum. We operate in a society, we're in a context. And when we have knowledge and experience that is useful to people, it's a responsibility for us to share that, and not just with the clients who pay us, but I think with the society as a whole. And I think that both makes our work easier because we contribute to the larger conversation and dialogue and hopefully influence views and attitudes about these things, but it also is part of our responsibility. And I find that that's a great way to learn. My attitudes about how to address vaccine hesitancy have changed dramatically in the 11 years since I started the blog, because I've engaged with a lot of people in different walks of life with different perspectives, and I've learned a lot about what people think and how they come to those beliefs, and how I can effectively address their concerns. So I think there are a lot of different avenues, and for people going to veterinary school, you're going to get all the immunology, you're going to get all the nitty-gritty of the science, but I think that once you come into practice, it's important to look at how you can apply that and translate that for people in a real world practical way.
Mm-hmm. No, I love that you mentioned that it's a responsibility, because that kind of just leads into the whole One Health idea, right? How anything that you're sharing, any information will influence people to make decisions, not just maybe with their pets, but just with the way that they treat their own health and how it connects all together as well. So it's really important for sure. YouTube is a great tool. That's awesome that you make YouTube videos, especially now. So I was just kind of wondering if you could, I know it's kind of going backwards a little bit, but could you just explain a little bit more about what vaccines really do for animals? Like maybe give an example of like one specific type of vaccine or something, but I think just for people to understand, like, you know, even if they haven't entered vet school yet, like what is the big, you know, benefit, I guess.
Sure. I mean, immunization is a fascinating thing. The way that vaccines work is really interesting. We have a whole system in our body, throughout our body, that is designed to keep us from dying as a result of contact with all of the other microorganisms that exist in the world, all the bacteria and virus and fungi and everything. And even though we don't always appreciate it, we swim in a sea of microorganisms. We are filled with billions of microorganisms. We live in a very active, vibrant, microscopic world that we're often not aware of. One of the favorite experiments that I did in my training was when I was a graduate student and I was teaching an undergraduate biology laboratory. And I would give people petri dishes, little growth media for bacteria. And I would say to them that, you know, apart from really dangerous things like body fluids, you can do anything you want with this. You can touch your sandwich to it, or set it out on your desk for an hour, or get some water from the water fountain and put it on the petri dish. And then let's see what grows. And people were stunned to see that everywhere in the environment, there are microorganisms. And if you give them an opportunity to grow, they'll grow. So we have a beautiful, intricate, complicated system for protecting us against those things. And whenever we encounter a potentially disease-causing organism through just everyday life, through eating or drinking or cutting our finger on a piece of paper, that system goes into action. And there are initial steps, what we call the innate immune system, which creates the inflammation you get. So when you cut your finger, it gets all red and sore because that's your immune system rushing there to help attack whatever is coming into your body. But we also have an immune system component that remembers things we've been exposed to before, so that we don't have to get sick every single time we get exposed to the same organism. I'm old enough, believe it or not, to have had chicken pox as a child. And I had a perfectly good Christmas vacation ruined by sitting around with these little incredibly itchy blotches all over my body because there was no vaccine for chicken pox. And I have these wonderful pictures of me as a very angry little boy sitting in front of the Christmas tree covered in red blotches. And my body experienced that illness and it was unpleasant, but I got through it. My immune system fought off the organism and I've never gotten chicken pox again because I have a lifelong immune memory that my body has created. So anytime I was exposed to chicken pox after that, my body was able to go, hey, I know that one, and get on it and kill it off right away before I had to get sick. Now there's a vaccine for chicken pox. So my daughter has no idea what I'm talking about and will never have to go through this, which is great. So the way that vaccination in general works is it simply teaches the immune system to recognize disease-causing organisms without having to go through the sickness, right? You might have a little soreness in your arm, you might have a low-grade fever for a day or two, but you don't get chickenpox from the chickenpox vaccine. Your body, however, learns to remember the chickenpox organism, so the next time you're exposed to it, it fights it off without you having to get sick. And that's in general how vaccines work. Tremendous oversimplification, lots of interesting details to go into, but that's basically how they work. And whenever a new disease comes along, we as research scientists learn how that disease is caused, how it works, and if it's an infectious disease, like COVID-19, for example, then one of the first things we do is try to figure out, can we prevent people or animals from getting this disease by teaching their immune system to recognize and fight it without having to have the illness? And of course, for all of us now who are trapped in our homes or trying to avoid other people, that's a really pressing issue. We're trying to figure out a way to do that that is safe and effective for us so that we can go back about our lives in a more normal kind of way. And in veterinary medicine, as I mentioned, the same thing has happened. When parvovirus came along, it took us a few years to figure out how to teach the immune system of our canine patients to recognize parvovirus. But when we give them that vaccine, then we don't have to deal with that disease. And I have a puppy with parvovirus in the hospital right now who unfortunately did not get that vaccine because of concerns that I think are not unfortunately based in science about the safety or the timing of vaccination. And that puppy will probably make it through that disease, though it's going to be very unpleasant for him. And I think that it's important for people to remember that that's still out there and still happens, just like COVID-19 is still out there, even though, you know, we're not leaving our house, so we're not getting it at the moment. And we have this wonderful tool available to us to help us to go about our lives safely. And that's how vaccination works for us.
Cool. That was a great explanation. And since you'd mentioned coronavirus, I actually had a question about that too. Well, you know, do you believe that this whole pandemic will really impact the way that people perceive vaccination as a whole and also within the vet industry?
I think it's a great question. I think it's a little too early to tell. We've seen both sides of it, right? The vast majority of Americans, for example, surveyed have said that they would take a coronavirus vaccine if it becomes available, 70% or so, because we don't like being afraid of infectious diseases that can hurt and kill us. And we don't like having to do all of the other things that help protect us, but that impede our everyday life. This is an opportunity for us to know what it was like for our grandparents or great-grandparents or for most of human beings throughout history to be vulnerable to these infectious diseases and have nothing you could do but hope for the best and try to stay healthy and try to stay away from it. So I do think there's a possibility that this will remind people of how valuable vaccination is and help dampen down some of the anxieties. I will say that the anti-vaccine movement has very aggressively targeted the idea of a coronavirus vaccine. There are already people out there saying you shouldn't get this. This is a plot by Bill Gates to put microchips in your body, or it's some horrifying thing that's going to ruin your health forever. And I think that's unfortunate, but not surprising. And I think it's a little early to tell how much impact this is going to have on people's general attitudes towards vaccination and public health interventions in general. I try to be hopeful, but I honestly think it's too early to know.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see even how the next generation of people handle that. Like, you know, if they're having children and all of those things where they need to decide to see if their kids should have vaccines or not, if that's going to impact them because they've gone through this pandemic. So it'd be really interesting to see that. But I was also wondering, like, you know, you're through all of this, you obviously, like you mentioned before, you're very focused on evidence-based medicine. Has that impacted the way that you perceive or approach vaccinations in general, like just even talking about it and all those things?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, for people who don't know, evidence-based medicine is simply a system for generating scientific evidence and then applying it in a practical, efficient way to making decisions for patients, right? And so it's not actually revolutionary in and of itself, but it helps us to do what we unfortunately aren't always that good at. Veterinarians are trained as scientists, but we don't always function with a scientific mindset or a scientific attitude. And part of that is because we have a very hard job. There's a tremendous amount of information to absorb and understand and then apply. And I remember being, you know, an early career veterinarian and just trying desperately to be competent and to remember everything and not to make a mistake. And the nuances of clinical decision-making took a little time to come. So evidence-based medicine, one of the ways that it approaches things like vaccination or any clinical treatment is to look in terms of risks and benefits and to use scientific information to understand what those are. And unfortunately, as human beings, we are often more impacted by personal experiences and anecdotes and narratives than we are by evidence and data. And so I think it's in your early days as a veterinarian, if you have a patient with parvovirus, for example, who wasn't vaccinated, that's likely to make you very aggressive about promoting that vaccine, right? Which is not a bad thing, but it's also taking a single experience and generalizing it in a way that's not always reliable. By the same token, if you have a puppy that has a vaccine reaction and has anaphylaxis and is injured by a vaccine, it may make you very shy about promoting vaccines in an appropriate way, even though that is not necessarily an experience that's representative of the overall risks and benefits to your patients. So part of our responsibility as members of a science-based profession is to understand that our personal experiences don't necessarily provide a reliable guide to the risks and benefits of vaccines or anything else. So as a proponent of evidence-based medicine, what I feel like is important is to understand what those risks and benefits are in a reliable, scientific, quantitative way. So for example, the tendency, and I think we undermine ourselves as veterinarians sometimes when we practice in a more thoughtless, less evidence-based way. The tendency to recommend that every dog and every cat come in for their booster vaccines once a year, no matter what, is in fact not an evidence-based practice. It's not recommended in any of the vaccine guidelines right now. And it's something that was done for a long time for reasons of convenience, to some extent for reasons of economics, because you want your clients to show up every year and to see you, and for reasons of fear. When you've seen a bunch of cases of parvovirus, you're going to want everybody to get vaccinated all the time because you don't want to see that anymore. But we have good evidence about how often dogs and cats should have particular vaccines. And, you know, in the case of, for example, the parvovirus vaccine, a series of vaccines as a puppy from about 8 weeks to about 16 weeks is necessary to achieve good immunity. A booster a year after that is appropriate. And then perhaps every 3 to 5 years, perhaps once or twice in a lifetime, may be sufficient to protect most of your patients. And we should follow the science on that rather than either the excessive anxieties of people who don't understand the science or the excessive anxieties of those of us who remember parvovirus and want to vaccinate everybody all the time. So evidence-based medicine has helped me to approach the risks and benefits in a more detached, more calm, and more scientific way. And to understand that people's anxieties either way are often based more on personal feeling than on the reality.
Mm-hmm. So how can, you know, students and young professionals who are maybe interested in getting to know more about evidence-based medicine, how can they kind of start off with that earlier on in their career?
Well, my hope is that this will become a part of the curriculum, and it has in a few places. I was actually fortunate to be asked to give a couple hours of lecture to the veterinary seniors at the University of Pennsylvania, which is my alma mater, on evidence-based medicine. And I am a member and used to be president of the Evidence-Based Veterinary Medicine Association. And we have tried to encourage the development of evidence-based medicine curricula so that, that this becomes a natural part of the process of educating young veterinarians. I often say, and I know it's hard for students who have plenty to memorize already to think in these terms, but I don't think anyone should graduate from veterinary school without having had a course in the history of science, the philosophy of science, and in cognitive psychology. Because what do we do for a living? We make decisions. And making decisions and making recommendations, taking information and turning it into practice, are all things that happen in our brains. And our brains have certain habits and certain ways of working that can lead us in the wrong direction or the right direction. And we should understand those and how they work. And science is a fantastic tool for helping us understand how nature works and how to do an effective job of protecting the health of our patients. And we should understand where science comes from and how it works. So to some extent, I hope that that becomes part of the training for veterinarians. For people who haven't had as much training in that as they'd like or who are interested, there are a lot of great resources out there. I'll plug my column again, obviously. I talk about this. And in particular, what I try to do is take specific practical subjects that clinical general practice veterinarians are going to see all the time and address those in an evidence-based way. So hopefully I can provide information about the topic, but also I can provide an illustration for how you use evidence-based medicine in the trenches as a real everyday practicing vet. There are a lot of great resources. There's a book called The Handbook of Evidence-Based Veterinary Medicine, which was put out a few years ago, which is a wonderful resource. The Small Animal Clinics series has a veterinary evidence-based veterinary medicine issue. So do all of the large animal clinics. So there are a lot of literature resources out there. And I have a book actually that came out last year called Placebos for Pets, where I talk to some extent about alternative medicine, some other topics, but I do talk about vaccination, I talk about nutrition, and I have several chapters at the beginning that are specifically about how do we know what we know in science and medicine, how does that knowledge come to us, how do we distinguish reliable from unreliable knowledge, and then how do we communicate that in an understandable and an engaging way to people who are not scientifically trained. So I think there are a lot of resources out there, and hopefully both within the curriculum and independently, people can find them, educate themselves, and see how useful this tool really is.
Wow, no, that's super interesting. And I mean, I think like you were saying that to explain to people that are not scientifically trained, right? Like it helps you do that. And I think that that's something that is so important for people to learn if they're trying to, especially when it comes to vaccination, if they're trying to like inform others, right? It's like you're so used to the terminology and you're so used to learning in that way, but other people have no idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right? No, we are translators in a way, right? Mm-hmm. We spend all this time acquiring this knowledge and this vocabulary, and occasionally I will hear a young veterinarian say a word to a client that's a very obscure technical term the client is never going to understand. And I will say, look, I realize you borrowed a lot of money to learn this vocabulary, mm-hmm. and so you feel obliged to use it, but there's a time and a place. And we have to learn as part of our practice, if not as our training, to communicate with people. And that's a tremendously important part of the job. Mm-hmm. And certainly with regard to vaccines, you know, that's as pressing an area for that as anything we do.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, on that note, like, I guess this is really my last question on the, you know, vaccination topic, but it's really just if, you know, can you share a story about a particular experience that you've had in regards to immunization, vaccination, and all of that within vet med that has shaped you or helped you grow or learn something?
Well, as I said, you know, I'm a little bit shy about individual stories, right? Because I understand how persuasive and how emotionally compelling they are, but I also understand that they lead us in the wrong direction sometimes. I will say that the kinds of things that lead me to think about vaccines or other veterinary treatments differently as I've gone through my career have more to do with how we think we know things that we don't actually know, which is often more dangerous than what we actually don't know. The example that comes to mind is not actually about vaccines, but it's a similar topic. I used to see a lot of feral cats for a feline rescue group when I was first in practice. And we had a protocol for what we did with these cats. They would come in, they would get their feline leukemia and FIV test. And then if they were negative, they would go on and get a series of vaccines. And it was all very regimented and we did it in a certain way because that was how it was done, right? And with regard not so much to the vaccine, but the testing, one of the policies for the rescue group was that if a cat tested positive for FIV, then they would be euthanized because this is a very serious communicable disease and we didn't want to release cats into the population and have them spreading this disease. And I was a little concerned about, well, gosh, I'm going to do this test and then I'm going to maybe have to euthanize these cats. And that's really hard for me personally. So I want to know how accurate this test is. So I did a little bit of research into how tests work. And you look at the insert for the test and it says, well, it's 98% sensitive, 98% specific, right? It looks really reliable. Great, I feel good about that. Then I ran across this evidence-based medicine concept called positive predictive value. It's a little complicated statistically, but the bottom line is, if you're testing for something that's really, really rare, even if you have a really good test, a lot of your positive tests are going to be mistakes. Because if you only have a couple of patients, if I have two cats out of 100 that have FIV, and my test gives me two false positives out of 100, which is pretty good, that means out of the four cats who test positive, two of them don't actually have FIV. Half of the cases that I'm euthanizing don't have the disease I'm euthanizing them for. And that really struck me, is that we didn't understand the tool that we were using and how it applied, and we were maybe making decisions that were probably not in the best interests of our patients. And so, you know, that experience led me to look at everything I do differently and to want to understand in detail the science behind what I do. So the same is true for vaccines, right? I would give vaccines annually because that was how I was taught to do it. And when clients started saying, you don't have to give them annually, instead of saying, oh, that's crazy, that's what I was taught in school, what do you know? I looked into it and I found that often that's actually true. There's evidence that you can give them less often and still be effective. So I think the bottom line, the message for me is that what you think you know but don't know can be really dangerous to your patients. And part of your responsibility as a clinician is to keep questioning your own understanding and your own knowledge and then to try to find the answers to those questions in the science. And that's what evidence-based medicine is to me. And that's how I approach all of these topics.
That's really good advice. Always questioning things, even if you're seeing, you know, any news, misinformation, always just doing your own research is awesome. Cool. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your advice and your experiences with our listeners. But we want to end every podcast with kind of a Q&A that showcases you and your goals and ambitions. So my first question is, what is your ultimate career goal?
That's really hard. I will say that because obviously I want to be inspiring to young veterinarians. And I remember how exciting it was when I finally got out of school and into the clinic and I was seeing patients and learning new techniques. And I learned to do ultrasound and I learned to do surgeries and it was all very exciting. I'm at a different point in my career, right? I've been in practice for 20 years and the day-to-day clinical work is a little less inspiring to me than it once was. It's still fantastic when a patient gets better and it's still heartbreaking when I lose a patient. But I've become more interested in the bigger picture, right? How do we learn to make decisions as veterinarians? How do we train veterinarians to make good decisions? How do we think about the relationship between science and clinical medicine? So I think probably my ultimate career goal, if I can call it a career goal, is to continue writing and teaching about how we think as veterinarians, how doctors in general think, and how that influences the way that we make decisions and the way that we educate clients. So I'm still in clinical practice and I probably always will be. I have clients that I've been seeing for 20 years and I'm pretty bonded to them and their second or third generation pets. But I'd like to do more of this sort of thing. I'd like to be more involved in how the profession evolves and changes as time goes by.
Awesome. Well, I mean, for all the listeners out there who don't know, Dr. McKenzie is also part of our next board. So if you have an anonymous question, feel free to send it and you can get a great answer. So our second question for you is, do you have a quote or like a philosophy that you live by that helps you, motivates you?
I mean, I think that I would say, you know, my goal has always been to feel like what I'm doing in my life is meaningful. And I think we all feel that way a little. And the quote that comes to mind is actually one from a favorite author of mine, George Bernard Shaw. And what he says is, this is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being thoroughly worn out before you were thrown on the scrap heap. So that's sort of how I think of it. I'd like to make sure that what I'm doing matters and that I put everything I have into what I do. As far as I can tell, I get one shot at this and I want it to count.
That's amazing. I love that. And so who inspires you to continue to make a change and do those things within the industry?
I think probably most of the inspiration at this point that I get is from the new veterinarians that I train. I teach clinical rotations in general practice for Western University as a preceptor. So I get senior veterinary students who are just on the cusp of starting their practice career. And I'm also in charge of training new veterinarians who come into our practice. And they remind me of that enthusiasm for the day-to-day practice that sometimes fades when you've been doing anything for 20 years, even something as amazing as what we get to do. So I think I'm inspired to not get old and to not get sloppy and to do a better job and to keep learning by the young people who come in and who are so excited and so passionate and so receptive to new ideas and new thoughts, which us old guys sometimes aren't.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're in the right place. So, and so what is your hope for the veterinary industry when it comes to vaccines and immunization?
Well, I hope, as we talked about earlier, that the experience we're all going through now with regard to COVID-19 helps us to appreciate how really critical vaccination is for health. And I have seen some waning in acceptance of vaccines over time for a variety of reasons. And I'm hoping that as a profession, we're able to connect with people and let them see that this is an incredible tool that really benefits their animals and that our interest in it is absolutely what's in the best interest of our patients, not economics or ideology. So I hope that we continue to make that case and we make it more effectively and we become a more science-based profession as we go along.
Cool. And the last one is, where can people find you? So email or social media, website, et cetera, if they want to reach out.
Sure. I'm pretty Googleable, so I'm easy to find in that regard. Probably my most noticeable internet presence is through my blog, which is theskeptvet.com. And you can certainly contact me through the contact page on the blog. A lot of people these days are more interested in short and sweet. So I actually have probably more followers on Facebook through SkeptVet than I do on the blog. And people can contact me. I'm happy. I love to take questions on any subject from pet owners or from aspiring or young veterinarians. I'm really interested in helping to encourage people to think in different and new and challenging ways about all of this stuff. So yeah, I hope people reach out.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks again, Dr. McKenzie. We obviously really appreciate you being with us. And a big thank you to our NextPod listeners. Remember, you are the future. Join us next month for another in-depth talk.